Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and here are some of the voices that made news this week.
This is not an innocuous drug. There are negative health impacts, dependence. Today, about 1 in 11 adults who use marijuana become dependent.
Smoking a joint in your home and not doing anything certainly is a victimless crime. If it was legal, it wouldn't be a crime at all, and it wouldn't hurt anybody at all.
Now, under current law, someone who chooses not to check that box off on the permit application, if the gun dealer or the state police puts the name in the system, the name is not there and the sale can go forward. The only change is that gun dealers and the state police will be able to determine if the application was filled out accurately.
The majority of murders that occur in the state every year are result of a domestic violence situation, many times something that's been festering for a long time and then finally boils over.
The Hannah Duston State Historic Memorial Site in Boscawen will keep its name for now. Republican State Representative Gene Sharon of Chester has withdrawn a bill that would have changed the name of the site to the Contoocook Island State Historic Site.
From the top, that was State Representative William Butinsky, Democrat of Hinsdale, speaking against a bill to legalize small amounts of marijuana, and State Representative Romeo Dineas, Republican of Nottingham, speaking in favor. Also, Democratic State Senator David Waters of Dover on his measure concerning gun ownership and mental health records. Assistant Safety Commissioner Earl Sweeney on a bill to change the way domestic violence is classified by the criminal code. NHPR's All Things Considered host Brady Carlson with an update on a controversial historic site, and Concord fourth grader Emma Servadio playing a piece she wrote and will perform this weekend at Carnegie Hall. Again, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and as we review some of the week's top stories, let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests on this week's Roundup are Anne-Marie Timmons, senior news reporter for the Concord Monitor. And Anne-Marie, nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be.
Also with us, Kevin Landrigan, State House reporter and columnist for the Telegraph of Nashua. And Kevin, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Great to be back, Laura.
And also with us, as always, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thank you for your time as well.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, first full week back at the State House for New Hampshire lawmakers. And boy, it was hard to keep track, folks. There was a lot going on. What were some of the major bills that you were watching, Dean?
Well, obviously, one of the big ones that we just had was a vote on legalizing small amounts of marijuana. The House narrowly passed the bill. There's be some amendments that has to go back to the Ways and Means Committee and then through the House again and over to the Senate. As we heard in the opening, there was this attempt to reclassify domestic violence into a separate category from other sorts of simple assault. Been discussion about controls or prohibitions on electronic devices in cars, which is a big topic of discussion. We heard about the guns and mental health. Just a lot going on this week.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's pick up then on that marijuana bill, because Kevin Landrigan, that got a lot of attention. This is modeled after a similar effort in Colorado. Is that right, Kevin? Just give us an update there.
Sure. Colorado and Washington are the only two states that allow marijuana to be possessed legally. Both were done by voter referendum in the last couple of years. New Hampshire would be the first legislature in the country to actually adopt this if we get that far, and I don't think we will. But I love this debate, and I love the result that happened. I mean, it was kind of quintessential New Hampshire House anarchy that we see in New Hampshire. And by that, I mean the New Hampshire House is just such an unpredictable place with 400 people. I mean, you had a committee recommend, let's kill this bill. You had a governor say, I'm going to veto this bill. Yet the House decided, we're going to pass this
bill. The heck with both of you.
The heck with both of you, and did it in really chaotic, kind of zany fashion. They first killed the bill, then they reconsidered that vote to kill the bill because supporters wisely figured out that a couple of people had voted the other way in order to reconsider it. They brought it back up. They were unable to kill the bill by two votes, and then they ultimately passed the bill by eight votes. What's interesting about this, too, to me is, you know, New Hampshire legislature, the profile, the demographic, it's one of the oldest legislatures in the country. So I think people across the country look at New Hampshire's kind of profile and say they're not going to – they're too old. They're not going to think the way the national trends have been going, which is more and more support for legalizing small amounts of marijuana. But I think the New Hampshire House really indicated and showed where the country is nationally, because the country is very split on this topic.
Wow. All right. Well, it's interesting, Kevin, and it shows how tricky the House is, because unlike in Congress, where if a bill is killed by committee, it's done. You know, in the House in New Hampshire, things can die. They can rise again. I mean, it's a continual phoenix for these bills, isn't it? They come up from the ashes again and again.
Yeah, it truly is. I mean, I worked in Massachusetts for 8 years where, you know, 80% of the bills never come up for a vote. A bill like this that the chairman didn't like would be put in a drawer and never be brought to the chamber for a vote. So you see in New Hampshire, this small D democratic process really works to everyone's advantage.
Well, and Emery, one of the other bills that Dean mentioned also got lots of attention this week, and also had some odd political pairings. This was the issue of guns and whether people with serious mental health issues should have access to them. This is from Democratic Senator David Waters of Dover. What's Senator Waters trying to get at here?
Right now, under federal law, it is illegal for someone who has been involuntarily committed to a mental health institution, found incompetent to stand trial, and some other categories to buy a firearm from a federal licensed gun dealer, which are our gun shops. The problem in New Hampshire, David Waters would say, is that we don't collect the records needed to confirm whether someone has or has not been committed and thereby disqualified to buy a gun. We don't provide those records to the federal check system. So when someone goes in, unless they self-admit that they've been involuntarily committed, there's no way to check that. So Senator Waters is wouldn't be expanding, really, who isn't legally allowed to buy a gun. He wants to provide the records so that gun dealers will be able to check people's claims that, yes or no, I haven't been involuntarily committed. What we saw at the hearing, Kevin and I were sitting together, and it initially looked like this was sort of a no-brainer kind of a bill. We were guessing 3-2 it would pass out of committee, but as the hearing went on, it became pretty clear that there's a lot to this that the committee was seriously considering. One is there's either a real fear or misinformation campaign about who this bill really would target. Several people said, you know, I'm never going to go see my counselor again because I won't be able to buy a gun. That is not who this bill targets. The other thing we heard that I think caught the committee's attention was that the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union said there's no data that shows that the mental health population, people struggle with mental illness, are any more violent than anyone else. And so that I think the committee really paid attention to that. My guess is that this will become a study committee, which is what the executive director of NAMI New Hampshire suggested.
The National Alliance on Mental Illness.
Yes.
Yeah. You want to jump in there,
yeah,
Dean?
A couple of comments on both of those bills. First, on the marijuana legalization. Kevin, I think that older demographic may be all the retiring boomers who grew up in the 60s and for whom smoking a joint or two is a form of relaxation. You know, there are a couple issues with the marijuana law. I think I think the first is that the experiments in Washington and Colorado are still very new, so we really don't know what's going to happen. There's still a lot of conflict with the idea that it's still illegal under federal law, so we have to see how that's going to play out. So I think there's sort of a wait-and-see attitude. The other thing is, the medical marijuana in the state is really just getting up and running now from a regulatory perspective. So that's a concern as well. So, Hassan's obviously opposed to it. I think the Senate will be opposed to it. But for me, it is an interesting indicator of larger changes in the political culture in the country on social issues. It's just, I remember 20 years ago, if you were a politician and you even said you tried marijuana, your candidacy was dead in the water. So it's a big change. On the mental health, Anne Marie mentioned the key point for me as a social scientist, this idea that there isn't data connecting being judged in court as having mental health issues and propensity to violence. I think that's an interesting link they have to prove.
Lots of other bills I want to talk to you folks about. Again, the number for you to join us on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can post a comment on our Facebook page, too, if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Curtis that just came in. In Europe, law enforcement respects your home unless there's physical harm. This is my home. Why can't the government stay out of my home? Whatever happened to live free or die? This is the idea, Anne-Marie. I think this person is talking about medical marijuana.
Yes, and I was going to add, Don, to this idea that our political, our house is aging. I think there's also, this real libertarian bent in New Hampshire. And I would suspect that a lot of this is, stay out of people's lives. This is harmless in some people's minds. And there is, I think that is a strong viewpoint. I also wanted to add, I went on the Governor Maggie Hassan's Facebook page this morning, and she had posted her reasons for planning to veto this bill. And there are over 900 Facebook comments on that from folks saying, this is hypocritical. That was the strongest message. We sell alcohol in this state. We license that. How is this different? How is this worse?
All right. We will take more of your comments and questions. Thanks for that email. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can post a comment there. Coming up, a couple more bills I want to go through, including one to change the way some large nonprofits are taxed, and a hearing yesterday on whether New Hampshire should repeal the death penalty. So we'll talk about that as well coming up. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. As a public radio service, the opinions and insights of our listeners drives much of what we do at NHPR. You can make your voice heard when you become a member of our Community Advisory Board. Find out more and fill out an application at nhpr.org. More of the New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. It's the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. New Hampshire weather becoming partly sunny across the state today. High temperatures, upper 30s to the lower 40s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank, providing complete business banking services to small to medium-sized businesses in New Hampshire. Information at centrixbank.com. And Concord Motorsport, performing all levels of automotive service for all brands, sensitive to customers' needs and cultivating a professional and welcome environment. ConcordMotorsport.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. On this week's roundup are Kevin Landrigan with the Telegraph of Nashua, Anne-Marie Timmons with the Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. And before we go back to our listeners, folks, a couple more bills that I really did want to follow up on with you guys about. Dean Spiliotis, texting while driving, distracted driving. This has been a big issue in New Hampshire lately. People have been killed by drivers who were texting and ended up hitting someone, former fire chief, and also a 14-year-old girl.
Right. There have been these recent high-profile fatalities that have been a result of distracted driving. Nowadays, whenever I hear a story on the news about somebody crossing over the median line and hitting another car head-on, occasionally it's a medical emergency, but very often it does turn out to be distracted driving. And they can check very accurately now in terms of whether you were using your cell phone, whether you were texting. So, there was a hearing in the state legislature on this issue. There was a lot of support for various measures to cut down on distracted driving. Hands using a cell phone with your hands, which is legal, although the state Supreme Court ruled, I think, last year or the year before that could be grounds for negligent homicide rather than manslaughter charges. So they are toughening the penalties for even legal use of cell phones that lead to accidents. Currently, you can read a text, but you can't text, you can't actually send a text. So there's sort of very limited controls.
Wait, right yeah. now you can read
you can,
a text
you can look at
while
a text
driving?
You can make a cell phone call. You can look at a text. You just can't actually key in or send a text. So it's a very sort of weak rule at this point. And there are other issues as well, like people who eat in their cars, read newspapers in their cars, put makeup in their cars. I've seen all of these. I had an amazing, experience a month or so ago. Coming out of the Hooksett Toll southbound, I came out of the toll, and three or four cars in front of me were all kind of weaving and drifting. As then I passed each car one by one, all messing with their cell phones. So it's become a real problem, and I think there is going to be some push for the restrictions. The problem is it's very difficult to enforce, because as long as using a cell phone with your hands is legal, people can just say, I wasn't texting, I was using my cell phone to make a call. You have to then go check the records to see whether they were texting or not.
How, Kevin, have other states dealt with this issue? I mean, this isn't just an issue in New Hampshire. The national transportation officials have talked about the increase in distracted driving.
They really have. And states are increasingly making more and more restrictions on the use of cell phones while driving. There are about 10 states now that actually outright ban cell phone use entirely. A supermajority of states now in the area, 30 to 35 states now won't allow anyone under 21 to use a cell phone in any way while they're operating a car. So it's a growing phenomenon. It'll be interesting. I think some ammunition will be added to this debate next week. There's a National Highway Safety Foundation group that's going to be ranking all 50 states, and I'm told that New Hampshire comes out as one of the 10 worst states with regard to highway safety. Seatbelts is a component. Helmets for motorcycle riders is also a component. But this use of communication devices while driving is also a component, and we rank very low and very lax compared to states.
Emery, do you want to jump in on this at all? It seems like it's a lot for people to wade through, like talking on a cell phone is one thing. Reading a text is another thing. I mean, at least when you're talking on the cell phone, you get your eyes on the road.
Right. And one of the bills would ban any sort of use of a cell phone up to your ear in your hand at all, one while you're driving. And then one of the bills just looks at folks who have sort of passengers, school bus drivers, taxi cab drivers. I still think there's a huge belief among people that if I just quickly send this text, it's not going to matter. And I think as we see more and more stories of people being hit, we will that's what it's going to take, unfortunately, to get people to take this seriously.
All right. Let's take some calls. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Mike's calling from Derry. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us. You're on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup.
Hey, thanks for having me. My first time caller.
Great.
I wanted to preface that as a police officer, the texting while driving, I've had just that, where people are literally driving off the road, and I assume that they're drunk driving, and they're not. And it is difficult to write a ticket for it, because a defense would be, I was dialing a phone number, and that is not texting. And we maybe get them as a distracted driving or reckless driving or something like that, and it may not tick up to that point, but the texting issue certainly needs to be addressed. I've had many accidents of just that, where they were sending a text and they say, yeah, and it usually is they admit that, yeah, I was sending a text and I didn't see the car coming or I drove off the road.
Yikes. So, and it is hard to figure out because by the time you pull them over, right, Mike, they may, you know, stash the cell phone or something else. So how do you think the state can better handle this, if anything?
Well, it's difficult because it would be an all or nothing. And I know that some people are really offended by, oh, the government shouldn't tell me what I can and can't do. But at the same time, it is certainly an issue for safety. The way the statute is written is you need to have both hands on the device. It's difficult for us to see that, you know, when people are driving by, even if 35 miles an hour, when they drive by to see whether they're on it. And do you write someone a ticket if they're on there, if they're texting while they're at a stoplight?
Right.
You know, so you have that discretion there. Is that still dangerous? While they're at the stoplight and you have to give them the toot to get them moving, I think it would be an all or nothing of either you can use your cell phones, which are computers, or you can't.
Wow.
I don't think you can have the in-between for enforcement purposes.
Which is sort of where we're at now, sounds like you're saying.
Yeah.
All right, Mike, good to hear from you. Thank you very much for calling in. Dean, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think Mike provides a sort of a real-world confirmation of what we've been talking about in terms of the realities of the problems of enforcing and dealing with these kinds of problems. One added wrinkle that I want to throw in there is internet usage in general. I recently helped my mom lease a new car, and the internet capability and entertainment capability in that car was mind-boggling. I mean, you have so many opportunities to you can make restaurant reservations, you can surf the web, you can pull up Pandora and listen to music. So, you know, it really, texting and cell phones are really just kind of the tip of the iceberg, because as cars are increasingly sold as entertainment centers to keep people entertained while they're driving, you're going to have all kinds of problems. And internet usage is currently not covered by state law.
Wow. All right. Mike, again, thanks for that call. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Kevin, I wanted to follow up on another bill with you. This is a heartbreaking hearing this week on possibly changing New Hampshire's domestic violence laws. First off, just give us the backstory, Kevin, on where this push to change how domestic violence is classified by the criminal code. Where does this push come from?
Well, you know, domestic violence is ubiquitous in our society. We see it on television all the time. The supermajority of homicides have a domestic violence component to them. But New Hampshire is one of 15 states that doesn't have a law that defines domestic violence as a crime. Instead, police like Mike and others have to charge individuals who commit domestic violence under assault crimes. The problem with this, essentially, is that there's really no way to know the prevalence of domestic violence, because you go into the data and you see a simple assault, and was that a simple assault because two guys were fighting over the Patriots versus the Broncos and a fight broke out, or was this a simple assault in which a husband got out of control and smacked his wife? That's what creating this domestic violence crime would do, would allow them to know how much this occurs. Is it increasing? Is it decreasing? It's very important. The emotional part, of course, that you referenced in the opening, Becky Raines from Amherst testified really passionately for this bill. Her son, Joshua, was the victim of that tragic murder-suicide that occurred at the Manchester YWCA, in which the estranged husband came in, broke, and during a visitation, killed his son and then himself.
Yeah, just some heartbreaking pictures on the cover of the paper. As a mother of a 9-year-old, you know, I felt that pain. How was it talked about, Kevin, that this might have prevented this tragedy? I mean, we're often looking back and saying, what could we have done? How would reclassifying this really would have helped in this case?
Frankly, it probably wouldn't have. It certainly wouldn't have prevented the father from losing control as he did and doing what he did. But I think it would simply give us a better idea of domestic violence in general. Is it a growing problem? Like I said, is it a decreasing problem? And this really assists the advocacy groups as well to obtain resources, federal grants, based on the prevalence of domestic violence.
Emery, go ahead and jump in.
When I was covering the police department, Concord Police, one of my duties was going through the police reports every week, looking at arrests, and a huge majority of those simple assaults were domestic related, often between fighting couples. And I think that's where this data would be most useful, because it would capture a lot of cases that just get blended in with, you know, street fights sort of, and show people the real numbers. Because this escalates. It starts off as, you know, fights at home and continues to escalate. And I think it would be helpful to see a warning signs of a case of a person who is escalating the violence, but also give us real numbers, because although the supermajority of murders are domestic related, there's even, you know, bigger numbers in terms of day-to-day assaults.
So that would help at least maybe a little bit of a better handle.
Give us real numbers
on the problem.
Yeah.
All right. Another bill that caught our attention this week, and I'll turn to you, Dean Spiliotis. Representative David Hess wants to change the way that some large nonprofits are taxed. You know, not the little soup kitchen down the street, but the big guys. Who's the target of this, Dean?
The main target are hospitals, private colleges, and other large nonprofits. You know, typically nonprofits get an exemption from the business enterprise tax. And so what they're looking to do is to try to recapture some of that revenue, particularly for, I think the bill would only include nonprofits whose revenues are over $2 million, so fairly large nonprofits. They're not going for the small nonprofit. And, you know, my sense is this has been fueled by a lot of stories we've read recently about hospital CEOs in the state who make $700,000, $800,000, college presidents who make $400,000. And, you know, if these enterprises are sort of very profitable money-making enterprises with highly paid professional staff, why should they be getting this BET exemption? So
BET is business enterprise tax
yeah. Right. Yeah. So that's the move, basically to go after these larger nonprofits who make in excess of revenue of over $2 million. So it's a fairly specifically targeted nonprofit bill.
And I know this has been an issue for Representative Hess for a while. We've talked to him about this before. Where do you think this is going to go, Kevin? I mean, hospitals and colleges are big employers in their communities and so forth.
Yeah, they're huge employers. I think Hooks, a Republican state representative, David Hess, is a dog with a bone. We've seen it on many issues before. He understands this is something that's going to take 5 or 6 years to accomplish. There's not the crying need for it right now. One, we don't need additional revenue. This would be a revenue-neutral bill, but we've seen what's happened when you raise a tax or you impose a tax on a new population. Somehow it ends up generating profit. Two, there's a real problem with regard to hospitals. They now pay over $80 million in the so-called Medicaid enhancement tax. We've talked about that here on this program. Hospitals have gone to court over how much they should have to pay in that tax. So they're not now exempt from paying this tax, but certainly this discussion is going to continue, and I think Representative Hess improved the bill a great deal by bringing it from 10,000 nonprofits to about 200 nonprofits. It really deals with nonprofits that make money for services rendered. So even groups with more than $2 million in resources would be exempt. Let's take the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. $50 million a year in resources. Assets, almost $500 million. They'd be totally exempt from this because they don't actually charge for a service and get paid in excess of $2 million a year.
Yeah, that's an important clarification. Thank you.
All right. And one more bill to follow up on. Anne-Marie, to you, please. A hearing yesterday on whether New Hampshire should repeal the death penalty. We've had a lot of discussion about this over the years here in New Hampshire. What's different this time, Anne-Marie?
We have two real cases that in the past years, the Michael Addison case, he was sentenced to the death penalty. And then we had John Brooks, who also charged with capital murder on, you know, actually more counts than Michael Addison. He was convicted but not sentenced to that. So we have it's not abstract. We have some real cases. There's also we have a governor that said she favors this, which is a first in a long time.
Favors the repeal. Yeah.
Yes, this repeal passed the House, I think, in 2002, and John Lynch vetoed it. So the folks who are opposed to the death penalty, you know, I understand why they feel remotivated. They feel like they have a governor who will support them. And the hearing yesterday was quite moving. Only three people spoke in favor of keeping the death penalty. One of them was Michael Briggs' partner, Nick Willard. of the Manchester Police, and he's you know, talked about having conversations with Briggs and shared that Briggs was a supporter of the death penalty. So you have that powerful testimony. On the other side, you have Briggs' former partner, John Breckinridge, who had a piece in our paper this week, also very powerful. He was a supporter, now is not, has found a different position through returning to his Catholic faith. So it's very emotional, very strong arguments on both sides, very well-intended people on both sides.
Yeah, it's interesting, Kevin. This year, the faith community seems to be jumping in even more. And just remind us, too, of the history on this. We almost came to repeal about a decade ago, maybe a little bit longer ago. Then Jean Shaheen, I think, vetoed the death penalty. Came close another time, but the Senate, I think, struck it down. So we've been back and forth on this for a long time,
yeah,
Kevin.
That's what's interesting, the history, and it also involves Governor Maggie Hassan. In 2000, the legislature passed this bill under Republican control in the House, and then Governor Jean Shaheen vetoed it. In 2009, the House of Representatives passed repeal under Democratic control, And Governor John Lynch supported the death penalty, said he would veto a death penalty bill. Maggie Hassan was Senate Majority Leader, and she mobilized Democrats and Republicans behind creating a commission to study the issue. The commission then split 10-9 over whether to keep the existing death penalty statute. Now that she's governor, and during the campaign, she indicated she would sign such a bill. It really increases the prospects for this, but its fate remains uncertain in the Senate. There's about six senators in both parties who are undecided. They'll determine what happens.
And I'm sure we'll be talking more about this in future roundups. I did want to turn to a political story. Dean Spiliotis, the executive director of the New Hampshire Republican Party, Matt Mowers, was subpoenaed this week by the New Jersey Assembly. How come?
And this is a fun story for state Democrats who have not skipped a beat and jumping on this story. Matt Mowers, as we know, is the current executive director of the New Hampshire State GOP. He was appointed in November, I think roughly the same week, right after Chris Christie had his big landslide victory as a re-election victory for governor of New Jersey. Matt Mowers was a field director or a field organizer for Governor Christie in New Jersey, and he is rumored to be the individual who actually asked the Fort Lee mayor's administration this is the Democratic mayor who declined to endorse Governor Christie. Mowers is apparently the individual who asked that mayor's office for an endorsement. Apparently, there was no direct communication with the mayor himself. But nonetheless, the New Jersey State Assembly is now doing an investigation. They have subpoena power. They've subpoenaed 17 individuals. He's one of those individuals. Jennifer Horn and others in the state GOP have come to his defense, saying, you know, there's no evidence of any wrongdoing, and he'll obviously, I guess, comply with a subpoena.
All right. Well, from New Hampshire to New Jersey and back, we'll talk more after a short break. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning. It's 9:39.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. President Obama is set to announce new guidelines for the National Security Agency, and West Virginia residents grapple with a chemical spill. Then a Senate panel concludes the attack in Benghazi was preventable. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Dana Center at St. Anselm College, presenting Canadian circus art with a lumberjack theme, Timber by Cirque Alphonse, January 25th at 7:30. Details at anselm.edu/Dana. And from the New Hampshire Liquor and Wine Outlets, presenting Wine Week from January 27th through February 2nd. A listing of wine tastings and events available at nhwineweek.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we'd like to hear from you as we talk about some of the top stories that made news in New Hampshire this week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Anne-Marie Timmons, Kevin Landergan, Dean Spiliotis, let's go right back to our listeners. And Karen's been waiting in Concord. Hi, Karen. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to make a comment about cell phone usage in cars. I just moved here from Australia about 4 weeks ago, And it's a really different in Australia, and it's been in existence for a long time, that it's not legal at all to use a phone in a car. And I can't remember how long that's been in existence. I'm going to say probably 10 or 15 years. And the rules have got slightly tighter over the years, to the point now that you can't actually have the phone in your hand at all. It has to be mounted on the car at eye level, so you're not distracted from taking your eyes off the road at all. Not even, you certainly can't text, and everything has to be hands-free.
And how well do people follow this? Yeah, go ahead.
All the time, very, very high penalties, hundreds of dollars fine, and it's monitored and policed very well, and to the point where I don't know anybody who people stop on their car actually and will pull off the road if they have to take a call and they don't have a hands-free system in place. But that saves lives, and that's the part I guess I find it difficult to understand. If it's saving lives, why isn't it put in place? Because I can tell you my next-door neighbour last year, a 42 and a father of two, was a cyclist, and he was killed because it was a young driver who was looking at his phone. It's illegal, and he shouldn't have been doing it. And my neighbour, you know, was killed on the spot. And it was devastating. He left behind a 12 and a 14-year-old.
Oh, my goodness.
And a devastated wife. And that's the result. I mean, people die when you look away from the road. That's what happened. And,
Karen, thank you so much for calling. What a terrible story, and also interesting to hear what they do in Australia. Jordan also sent an email about this. He says, often I feel urged to respond so that the person trying to contact me by text doesn't think I'm ignoring them. People only call now if it's deemed important. Texting has replaced voice. If there was an automatic reply, I could activate my cell phone saying, auto response, I'm driving and will respond ASAP. I would absolutely use it. Jordan, thank you for that email. Vicky posted a comment on our Facebook page about our conversation on the marijuana legalization. She says, number one, people say it's a gateway drug. I would say a gateway to the fridge, maybe. And two, Vicky says, there is less of a chance someone will harm themselves or someone else from smoking a little bit of pot than someone who drinks a little bit of liquor. And I'm sure, Vicky, that that's something that's going to come up in these hearings on this bill as it goes through the process, as Kevin Landrigan described earlier. So thanks for those comments. And I want to also turn to another story that we do need to follow up on, and that has to do with, believe it or not, folks, an election. Kevin Landrigan, Republicans north of Concord will have to vote in a primary election in just a few days to pick their nominee for the Executive Council after longtime Councillor Ray Burton died last year. Just remind us where this district is and who's running to be the Republican nominee. We've got this primary first.
We do. District 1 encompasses almost 40% of the land mass of the state. It goes from the Canadian border down within 15, 18 miles away from Concord in both the east and western part of the state. It's a significant, not only a significant part of the state, but one that, because of the different socioeconomics that exist, we have the southern tier that's more economically vibrant. We have the north country that really struggles. A lot of demands on that councillor, and certainly Ray Burton was someone who wanted to deliver upon them. I'm not sure someone can adequately replace Ray Burton, but that person's going to try, and we have a very vigorous primary. I recall, by the way, talking with Ray Burton, who had been there since the late 1970s, who do you want to replace you? And he would never say who he wanted, but he said he wanted 20 people to run, that that he felt he understood he'd be leaving a huge vacuum once he left. And we have a very vigorous primary between three very different people. Chris Boothby from the Lakes Region, Belknap County Commissioner, longtime executive with Lakes Region Healthcare, a political moderate, Joe Kenney, former state senator, former Republican nominee for governor from Wakefield, again, very conservative, trying to return to political life. Mark Aldrich from Lebanon, who for 20 years was a really seasoned and very trusted aide to two former U.S. Senators from New Hampshire, Gordon Humphrey and Bob Smith, a very likable guy, again, a very conservative person. This one's a tough one to call.
There's some very impressive experience on that
Tuesday.
List.
There is very impressive experience, and it's January 21st, and I could not tell you who the heck is going to go to the polls for an election on January 21st. It's probably, despite the size of this landmass, the total vote could be in the few thousands. So someone who is very conservative and is linked to the important constituencies in the right wing of the Republican Party, that would be Joe Kenney, stands probably a better chance in a low turnout election. I'd give the edge to Chris Boothby by right now, but if you tell me who's going to vote, I'll tell you who's going to win, and we really don't know.
Wow. Well, real interesting. It'll give us something to talk about next week on the roundup. And Marie, I did want to ask you about Governor Hassan taking a stance this week against the idea, against a bill that would have allowed some limited tax money to flow to private religious schools. She filed an amicus brief in a Supreme Court case on this. Just give us a little background on this and what the governor said.
This came as a surprise to some because the governor in this case is going against the Attorney General's office, which is defending the law. But anyone who has watched the governor campaign and then in her early days of office, well, you know, wouldn't be surprised. This is something she's opposed from the get-go. In her mind, it's an, you know, voucher system, take money from public schools, give it to private schools. So she has filed an amicus brief with asking that the Supreme Court uphold a lower court decision, repealing the law.
The law basically says businesses can contribute a portion of a tax they would normally pay to a scholarship fund, and that scholarship fund can go to a variety of
homeschools, private schools, and it's a small scholarship. My understanding, $1,500 or so. It's small money. People who want it say any little bit helps. But she has long been opposed to this issue.
And so people were sort of surprised, but sort of not, because she's going against the Attorney General's office. To me, that is surprising.
Right.
I didn't realize that.
Yes, it's been her position all along. But, you know, usually see on these issues, I think, the governor's office staying out of it or not, or being on the same side as the Attorney General.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's something else we'll have to follow up on, because I know that's going to be progressing this week. We talked a minute ago about the race to fill Executive Counselor Ray Burton's seat. He passed away late last year. Kevin Landrigan, this week, a lawmaker of note passed away, Richard Stretch Kennedy of Hopkinton, a guy who made headlines for a long time, both statewide and here in the Concord area.
Yeah, really, literally a larger-than-life figure, almost 6 feet six, nearly 300 pounds.
Hence the nickname Stretch.
A very, very conservative Republican, but always a very good-natured guy. Someone who loved his guns and loved conservative causes. I remember being at his house when I was doing a profile. This is almost over 15 years ago. I saw about 100 guns in his house mounted on the wall in various places. And I said, Stretch, this is incredible. I've never seen so many guns. And Stretch looked at me with a wry smile and he said, my arsenal is in the basement. Meaning he had many more. In fact, someone joked this week that the National Rifle Association wants to have the estate sale that would give away all these guns. But a very generous man, a man of great wealth, who often saw a cause, not a liberal cause, not a conservative cause, but a people cause, and kind of quietly got behind it. There was a record-setting state legislator, Dan Healey, a Manchester Democrat, who had passed away. And Secretary of State Bill Gardner often had driven him to and from the State House and really loved Dan Healey greatly, wanted to have a portrait of Dan Healey mounted near the entrance to the House of Representatives. It was right in the middle of the session. So much was going on. How's this going to happen? How are we going to be able to afford this portrait? Stretch Kennedy walked into Bill Gardner's desk the next day and wrote a check paying for the portrait.
Wow.
And it went up.
So a strong Republican, but willing to help out a Democrat in distress, so
absolutely.
To speak. Wow. Real interesting. Again, the number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. By the way, on our Facebook page, we also have links to some of the stories we're talking about this week. 1-800-892-6477. Let's take another call, all of you. This is Jim in Dover. Go ahead, Jim. You're on the air and welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Actually,
sure.
I'm Jim Brashear, and I'm the state rep from Stratford District 13. And so I've been following the issue about the amicus brief that the governor has filed. And I just wanted to make the comment that your commenter talked about is just a small amount of money, and that may be true for the scholarships, but we're really talking about a potential for millions of dollars in tax revenue being diverted if this program goes forward as it's planned.
Sounds like you oppose this idea, Jim.
I ran. This was the straw that broke the camel's back for me, and the reason I ran for the first time in my life in 2012.
Wow. Okay. Thank you very much for calling, Dean Spiliotis. There's some real strong feelings and some politics behind this.
Yeah, this is actually a very interesting issue because it has caught the attention of numerous national advocacy groups who actually support these fellowships. You know, they're pointing out that I think 9 or 10 other states have upheld this kind of law. You know, for me, one of the interesting aspects of it is this distinction between homeschooling versus, you know, parochial schools. And I think that the lower court made a distinction, and now the Hassan administration is just making a general argument that this violates church and state. So, you know, I always look for these kinds of issues that tap into kind of the larger culture wars in the country, and this is certainly one of them, and I think it will continue to be. So I was not surprised in one sense to see this brief being filed.
You know, I wanted to ask about another story that has to do with a controversy that happened a long, long time ago, Emery, and you know where I'm going with this. This has to do with Hannah Duston. This is the woman who in 1697 killed and took the scalps of as many as a dozen Native Americans while escaping captivity. What happened with Hannah Duston this week, and why has this been such a big issue?
The memorial site to Hannah Duston in on land in Bosquin is a very uninviting, tired, a little sketchy kind of place to go, especially at night. I wouldn't
just
go down
there. Concord, yeah.
Yeah, it's close. It's also it's hard to see a little bit. There is a park and ride in the parking lot, and then if you go brave yourself down into the bushes and along spray-painted railroad tracks, you'll come upon the Hannah Duston memorial, a statue of her holding some scalps. There was a desire by the parks, state park system, to clean up the site, but also tell a different story. They wanted to rename the site the Contucuk Island Park, I believe. Is that
Contucuk Island State Historic Site?
Right, and that Contucuk is an Abenaki word, and this was an Abenaki living place. And so the idea was to, some people would say, sanitize the Hannah Duston story and tell more of the story of the Abenaki. There was a debate about that. The state ultimately discovered that it did not actually own most of the land on the Hannah Duston site that belongs to Bosquin. And Bosquin did not want to go this route, didn't want to rename it.
Now, why didn't they want to?
It's part of their history. They view it as a history. They wanted to keep that history. I don't think they were opposed to adding to the history and telling a fuller story, but they did not want to take away this part of the history. So the compromise and the plan now is to put some resources into that site, make it more inviting, clean it up, but also tell a full story with signage of the, you know, the full story of the life that the Abenaki had on that piece of land and the story of Hannah Duston, to bring those two together, not just tell the one story as is the case now.
Is that going to happen?
That's the plan.
Yeah, and someone's going to have to find money to do that. That's
right.
That's always the issue.
Right, yeah.
All right. Well, all of you, I did want to ask what you are planning to cover next week. I want to let you know that next week on The Exchange, we're going to look at the gas tax debate, both as it's unfolding here in New Hampshire, but also in other states. We'll take a look outside New Hampshire. We'll look at some new approaches being tried elsewhere for transportation funding. So we'll be talking about that next week. Also, Nick Tumpas is going to be here, the Commissioner of Health and Human Services. How about you, Kevin? What are you going to be watching next week?
Well, the casino bill is back. We'll have a hearing, but this isn't your grandfather's casino bill.
Really? This is different?
This is different. Jaffrey, Democratic Representative Richard Ames, chaired that commission. This has a really robust regulatory regime. It creates a whole gaming commission that would have control over not just casinos, but lotteries and charitable gaming. It contains some really tough laws on trying to clean up some of the abuses in charitable gaming right now. And so, and it also would allow for more than one casino, up to two licenses in the state. We'll see whether it gets a different wrinkle. The House, since the lottery was legalized, has not supported an expansion of legalized gambling other than a large volume scratch ticket. And we saw a casino bill die by 35 votes last year. It's got a tough road to hoe, but this is a different bill, and I think it'll be a slightly different debate.
Okay. And how about you, Anne-Marie?
I'm working on my R&R. I'm heading to Panama tomorrow for a week's vacation.
Panama? Wow.
Yeah. So I did a fellowship at Harvard a couple of years ago and had fellows from all over the world, so that means there's lots of places to go on vacation now. And we're a group of us are having a little mini reunion in Panama.
Super. Well, go through the canal and tell us about that next time. Dean Spiliotis, how about you?
I'm going to be watching that January 21st Executive Council primary to see just how low that turnout is. The conventional wisdom among political sciences, low turnout typically favors in a Republican primary the conservative candidate. But I'm increasingly spending a lot of my time talking both locally and nationally about Chris Christie, Scott Brown, and a sprinkling of Rand Paul. There was a new public policy polling poll out a few days ago. Chris Christie at 24% in New Hampshire, Rand Paul at 12% in New Hampshire.
Okay. Always the political angle from
that's
you, Dean Spiliotis.
Right.
Thank you so much. And one more news item. This weekend, a Concord fourth grader, Emma Servadio, will be playing piano before an audience at Carnegie Hall. You heard me right, the Carnegie Hall. Now, Emma happens to attend school with one of my sons, and she played at the school's concert on Monday. So we're going to close out this hour by saying good luck and congratulations to Emma, and we'll share with you a little of the piece she wrote herself and that she'll be playing. It's called Swan.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, for Martin Luther King Day, we'll play back our earlier conversation with Granite Staters reflecting on the 50th anniversary of King's I Have a Dream speech. Then we ask to raise or not to raise the gas tax. That's what New Hampshire lawmakers are debating. We'll examine the arguments. And later, we talk with Health and Human Services Commissioner Nick Tumpas. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show with the Domestic Hour of the Friday News Roundup is next at 10 on NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Ellen's Interiors, New London and Cambridge, Massachusetts, dressing your windows with an array of beautiful and energy-efficient Hunter Douglas window fashions, ellensinteriors.com. And Centrix Bank, see beyond with Centrix, customized business banking for businesses, professionals, municipalities, and non-for-profit organizations, online at centrixbank.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Later this morning, President Obama is expected to announce new limits on how the National Security Agency conducts surveillance. Congress reaches a budget deal that avoids another government shutdown. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie gives his State of the State.